Welcome to What's Eric Eating? Culture Map's bi-weekly look at all things Houston bars and restaurants. I'm your host, Culture Map editor Eric Sandler. Today on the show, I'll have a conversation with someone in the food world I think you'll want to hear more about. He is the chef and owner of Chef's Table, a restaurant with locations in Vintage Park and recently opened in River Oaks. Paul Friedman, welcome to the show. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here, Eric.
I'm excited you're here. I feel like this has been a long time coming. You know, whenever I have someone on the show for the first time, I always like to learn a little bit about their history. So tell me a little bit about how you got started as a professional cook.
Yeah, well, actually, Eric, I never ever dreamed or thought I'd be a chef or a cook. But for me, you know, growing up in South Africa, I wanted to explore the world. And so initially, I had to go to the army. And when I got out of the army, I wanted to explore the world. So I went to Europe for about 8 months. And I took a Eurovail pass to get there. It was all the money that I had, actually. And so I was able to go to 7 different countries and travel on a rail. And so I figured if I slept on the trains, I wouldn't have to pay for a hotel. So I'd find a place to get on a train at night and arrive in another city in the morning. And it turned out to be really the way to go. But what I had to figure out was how I was going to eat, because I didn't have money. And so I didn't want to work either, because I was wanting to explore. So I figured out very early that if I got off the train in where the trains actually come to me, like the center of the city, if I walked about a mile away from the actual center of the city, I'd find little mom and pop shops. And I played around a little bit, and I said, look, I'm lost. And I spoke English. They couldn't speak English because it was either Italian or French or German, wherever I was. And but they understood sign language. And I act like I needed a knife and a fork and I had no money. I showed them my pockets were empty. And they took me in like I was their lost child. And I ate for almost 7 months without paying for anything. So I got around. But anyway, when I got back to South Africa, I kind of figured, you know, I really fell in love with food, but not in a way that I was going to present to be a chef or a cook. But I applied to a guy who had a restaurant, two restaurants, and a long story short, I became his manager, and him and I went on to open 28 restaurants together in South Africa. But my job was operations, just like what my son is doing for me now. And my job was to get the plans, go and find the subcontractors, build the restaurant, and hand them over to a manager or a licensed person that was going to be running it. And after 8, 9, 10 locations, I found myself having to train people how to cook. And so that's how I got started. But I was never, I never went to school. I had no culinary background, still have no culinary background. I don't look at recipes. I don't want to copy somebody else's food. So I want to create my own style of food. And so I've been blessed that when I create something and it tastes good on my tongue, then it goes on the menu. And I'm just fortunate enough that people love my food.
All right. So how did you learn to cook then, if you didn't go to culinary school and you were the general contractor, for lack of a better word, the operations right. guy for all these restaurants?
Well, yeah. I got involved with actually designing the kitchens and setting the kitchens up. And so having done that, it was easy for me to try to explain to people why the grill was where it was, or the fry station where the fry station was. And so there was a recipe book with the initial restaurant chain, which was Mike's Kitchen. And so I could duplicate that, but it wasn't something that I was creative on my own. So that became over time. When I started teaching people how to cook the Mike's Kitchen way, then I developed all these other kind of tastes that I had in my mouth, which became my own recipes. So I learned how to cook with flavor. So for me, like if I'm doing a curry dish, the curry has to be there, but it cannot overpower the dish. because I want everything else to be tasted. So if you've got the roasted coconuts and the chutney and the onions and peppers, you've got to be able to experience that whole dish with not being overpowered. Like with a hot sauce, I make a hot sauce, but it's not so hot that you sweat. It's there designed to warm the food, to enhance the food, not to kill you with something that's really spicy. But anyway, I love cooking now. I really, it's become part of my life. And I enjoy teaching, because that's what I was doing all through my life, teaching people how to run a restaurant or to operate the food or to design the kitchens and so on. So it's been an interesting journey. I had several different concepts along the way.
Right. So when did you leave Mike's Kitchen and go out on your own and kind of embrace this title of chef as opposed to operations?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I came to the United States with Mike's Kitchens, and we opened 3 locations here in Houston. And then my partner decided to get into the travel business, and we opened a travel company because at the time the World Cup soccer was actually in South Africa at the time. So we were doing tours to South Africa back and forth. And my partner got so heavily involved in the travel business that he sunk everything that we had with Mike's Kitchen into the travel business, and Reagan imposed sanctions against South Africa, and we lost everything. And so that's when I started to, I'm on my own. Now I'm going to have to figure out what I'm going to do. And I applied to, and I was here in the U.S. at the time because we had 3 of the Mike's Kitchens here. And of course, that was unfortunately went down with the sale of the restaurants to get out of the travel industry. But then I found myself working for a guy who had a pizza shop. It was called Geppetto's Pizza. It was on Lexington Boulevard in First Colony here in Houston. And he had another location, which was on Bel Air Boulevard. And I landed up taking that from him, and I started learning how to create pizza. And I went out on the street corner handing little samples of pizza out when people were coming. I was looked like a homeless guy, but I was actually handing samples of pizza out. And so people were stopping by, and I was handing them pizza, and they'd drive right around the corner and come in and try their pizza. And I became really famous for pizza. And So I added wings, and I added subs, and I added ribs, and I started doing all these other things. And I had actually 5 pizza shops in Houston at the time. And then I got involved with a lot of other concepts like the Great Charcoal Chicken Company. And so along the way, I've been doing different concepts before I even got to the Peli Peli concept. And that was Peli Peli when, I mean, I created Peli Peli. I was so excited. I had the opportunity to have the financing. I'd made enough money. I've been married for 24 years. And all of a sudden, my wife decides, I've had enough. I'm leaving. So she took everything, including the money. And then I found myself having to find partners. And that's when I found Michael and Thomas. And Michael and Thomas, they had a POS company. And so I had put like a POS system into my Paul's Pizza Shops. And that's how I met Michael first. And then Thomas started working with Michael. And they said, look, if you ever open a restaurant, we want to partner with you. And so perfect, when things got to the point where I'd lost everything, who did I call? I called Michael and Thomas, and they became my partners with Peli Peli. And we've had a big history together. We opened quite a lot of Peli Peli restaurants, had a great name. It was fantastic. We had a good run.
Yeah, I want to spend a little time talking about Peli Peli before we get to Chef's Table, just because it was kind of how you came to prominence locally. It's certainly how we met the first time. Because it was this kind of phenomenon, you know, to open up in Vintage Park when there really wasn't a lot out there. It certainly wasn't a part of town that I was familiar with. And to do pretty traditional South African food, I mean, certainly your version, but to do the bobotie and to do, you know, some of these other dishes, like the King Clip, stuff that's still on your menu now at Chef's Table, it was pretty innovative. It wasn't really something that people were used to. So just kind of look back on that and what do you kind of remember from those early days and how you kind of built the reputation for Peli Peli?
Yes. Well, I'll start with Thomas and I went around looking for a place to open up Peli Peli. And so Villa Borghese had a concept in the Galleria. I mean, yeah, he had started Uptown Park in the Galleria, I think it was. And we were looking to go into the one of the spaces that were there. And he said, no, I'm building a new location up in the Vintage Park area. And I think this would be a great opportunity for you, which is why we ended up going into that particular complex. That's how we got there. And then starting out with the concept of Peli Peli, it was almost like, okay, this is where I was born. I was born in South Africa. How can I represent South Africa and give people an understanding of what South African cuisine is? And right in the very beginning, I thought about, okay, let's talk about what South Africa really is. And so the first Caucasian people to actually establish themselves in South Africa were the Dutch, and they formed what was known as the Dutch East India Company. And it became known as the spice route from the east to the west, because actually, when you come down from India, the Indian Ocean brings currents from the north down to the south. And then as you go from the Indian Ocean to the Atlantic Ocean would push people up north to the west. And so that became known as a route for ships that had sails. So they'd ride the sails down to the point of Africa and then ride the sails back up to the west of North America. So we have a lot of the Indian influence with the curries and cardamom and spices and so on. The Dutch were there, of course, forming the Dutch East India Company. They were farmers, taught us how to make jams and jellies and chutneys and that kind of thing. And then also the British came down. They colonized the area. So we had a lot of British influence. And then the French were thrown out of France as the Huguenots. So we had a lot of French influence. So we had winemaking from the French and so on. So a lot of little different cultures. And then, of course, the Portuguese formed a Portuguese colony of the East Coast called Mozambique. So we had Portuguese influence as well. So when I decided that I was going to enter into competitions, I thought, what a wonderful way to enter into a competition by making babuti, which was a dish that is very well known in South Africa. And babuti is like ground beef with a mashed potato, a beat up egg, and put into the oven and baked. A very plain dish, but it's very popular.
Yeah, somewhere on the spectrum of shepherd's pie. And
yes. And you know, if you use beef, it's called cottage pie. But if you use lamb, it's called a shepherd's pie. So I use ground beef, and I used India as my base. So I made a ground curried beef representing India. And then in the middle, instead of a plain mashed potato, I added carrots, leeks, and potatoes to make a mash that represented Great Britain. And then the French got a nice pastry crust on that. And then the Dutch got a mango peach chutney. So there was four different countries represented in this little cottage pie. And it won this award at the Chef of Chefs. I mean, humbly received a $5,000 check with a nice Waterford Crystal trophy. It was a big deal, man. I'm telling you, it was. I didn't expect it. It was amazing. So that was an introduction of a little bit of South African cuisine. And then of all the other things that I'd learned along the way with opening up Mike's Kitchens and all the other dishes and lamb chops and steaks and chicken and seafood, a lot of fish that we get from there, even now with what I had with Peli Peli, but more so now with the Chef's Table, I'm importing a lot of stuff from around the world, which makes my restaurant very different. But that was how we kind of got the name out initially. And we were fortunate because we started entering into a lot of competitions with the wine companies and the wine festivals and so on. And we went to the Katy Festival and represented by Kroger and all these other. In fact, you were a judge at one of those where actually I think I met you for the first time.
Oh, that's probably right. Yeah, there was some event like it in the Memorial area, right, where I agreed to judge. That was back in the days when I said yes to everything.
Yeah, no, right. That's when we were actually, doing all these events.
Right, and you told me about this restaurant that was almost all the way to Tomball that I had to come try, and I took you up on it.
You did. Yeah. So we've actually known each other for quite some time now.
Yeah, I'm 2013, 14, somewhere like that. I think I've known you. I've known you for a long time, and Pelle Pelle was quite successful in its day, as you said. I mean, you started at Vintage Park, you went to the Galleria, you did Pelle Pelle Kitchen, a fast casual concept.
I think, you know, the problem or the issue that we had was, you know, this when it's a chef driven restaurant, it takes time to build a reputation. It also takes time to train, teach people. You've got to be able to have the people that are working in the kitchen, for example, to understand the flavor profile, because it's very difficult for somebody like myself to say, well, this is what it tastes like. Well, you may know what it tastes like, but you really don't know what it tastes like because you've never grown up with it. I mean, so many people will say, well, my grandma used to make this recipe and I know what it tastes like, but I don't know how to make it, or the other way around. So it's important to be able to, and I think what I would have loved to have done, I would have loved, and maybe even to this day, with a chef's table now, as we're growing, I think it would be important if I could probably send one or two of the chefs over to South Africa for a 3-week tour or something, and take them around to all the restaurants and let them taste actually what it is like to taste South African food there, different from what I'm doing here. So it's hard. I mean, I might tell you, well, this is what a Borevoor sausage tastes like. But if you've never tasted before, you don't know really what it tastes like. You're just taking my word for it. So, you know, I think it's important to when you come from somewhere, to know what that is or know what that's like. And you can't just grow a concept as quickly as Pelle Pelle did and expect that it's going to be successful. It takes time. Like anything, like if you have a baby, it takes time. A child right. takes 3-4 years before you stop changing the diapers and stop eating it with milk, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
All right. So your time with Pelle Pelle came to an end. The restaurants rebranded and then closed. You know, we don't need to go into the ins and outs of all that. But then how did you decide kind of the time was right to come back? And how did you, you know, in some ways, Chef's Table is really an evolution of what you were doing at Pelle Pelle. So how did you decide that was how you wanted to continue your career?
Yeah. Well, you know, I got a phone call from Dunhill. And Dunhill is the company that owned the property at Vintage Park. And they called me and said, hey, listen, this is right in the middle of COVID. I mean, it was in 2020. Of course, a lot of restaurants closed down. Unfortunately, there were situations where the government was trying to help restaurants serve alcohol, deliver alcohol, all that kind of stuff to help them afloat. But at that time, the concept of Pelle Pelle got to a point where the Dunhill Corporation shut them down. And I wasn't there at the time. I had left already. I'd left in, I think it was at the end of 2018. And then I got a phone call from Dunhill, and they asked me, they said, hey, listen, we'd like to offer you your restaurant back. It's the one in Vintage Park, and everything is there. You can just go in and start operating. And I felt that, you know, that would be great. But I think for me, having been left for a couple of years, I think I wanted to start a new concept. And, you know, at some point you could start again. But I feel like, you know, it was time for a new chapter. And so I said to them, look, I appreciate it. But if I come back, I don't want to come back as Pelle Pelle. I'd rather start over, start a new concept. And I know my son is going to get involved because he's a construction guy and he's amazing at what he does. And so I'll give him a call and see what he thinks. And so Kyle and I went to the Vintage Park location. We went in there, we had a look, and we decided we were going to take the whole thing down and start over, which we actually did. And I got help from Dunhill, the owners of the Vintage Park complex. They signed a new lease with us. They gave us an opportunity to rebrand it. Help us financially a little bit with some additional tenant improvement. And my son being in construction helped a lot. And so we decided to go ahead and do it. And it was right in the middle of COVID. And everyone thought we were absolutely insane. What are you doing? Why are you opening and spending all this money on a new concept in the middle of this pandemic? I mean, you guys are nuts. You don't know what you're doing, right? And so we were able to get through with our lease without having to pay rent until the pandemic was actually over, which was great because we had time to build it, time to get established. And of course, you know, I'm the guy that I will go out on the street corner, hand out samples to get people to come in.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So that was great. And then, you know, it was hard. It wasn't easy. I mean, we had to start over. It was like what I'm doing right now with River Oaks. It just takes time. You can't expect to just open the door and people are going to be lining outside. I mean, we all wish that. We all would want that. But sometimes you have to, humble yourself a little bit, you know, and not be so cocky and think, oh, man, we're going to open another one, you know. But the reason I opened this one, I'm blaming my son. You know why? He said to me, Eric, he said, hey, Dad, this was a couple of years ago before we opened or even thought about River Oaks. He said, I got an opportunity to open a restaurant with some other guys. I said, what? He said, yeah, I just wanted to see what you think about that. And I said, no, son, if you're going to open another restaurant, you're going to open that with me, not with somebody else. And so it wasn't my plan to open another restaurant, but I feel like my son forced me into it. But I couldn't be happier that he did.
All right. Well, take a half a step. We'll talk about River Oaks in just a second, but take half a step back. Talk to me about like creating the menu for Chef's Table and kind of what did you decide? What from the Pelly Pelly days did you decide to keep or what did you change or what did you add to differentiate Chef's Table from Pelly Pelly?
Right. Well, the first thing is that I had to think about what were the things that people liked that were different from any other restaurant, the dishes that I had created. And so, you know, as far as like, okay, a mashed potato, I took carrots, leeks, and potato. I called it carrot gravy. That was my mashed potato. So you look at things like that, right? And you take things from the menu that were so different and so unique that people gravitated towards because it was, and it was very flavorful as well. So I looked at all of those dishes. I had the knowledge to know which ones were popular and which ones weren't. And there were quite a few of them that were not popular. So I left those out. And then I decided to keep the ones that were the most popular. And then I decided that I was going to add a lot of other things that we didn't do that we should have done that I felt like my partners didn't quite think that ostrich and impala and Iberico pork and those things that I now have on my menu and octopus coming from Spain and so on would be things that would actually people would love. And so I decided that now I'm going to, in addition to those things, I'm also going to add all these other things that I never really got to do when I had Pelly Pelly. So, yeah, and I continue to do so. Oxtail used to be very cheap. It's become very expensive, and it's a great dish. It's like, why not use that as ossobuco? Because it makes a really good dish with the cartilage and everything that's on there. It just has great flavor to it. So, I mean, I'm not copying anybody, Eric. I'm just trying to be creative and bring in things from my childhood that I would have put on my menu anyway, whether people thought it was going to be good or not. And it just so happens that ostrich is becoming one of my biggest sellers at the Chef's Table. People are eating it and they love it. And it's high in omega-3, it's high in iron, and it's no fat. And it's like eating a rare filet. So I'm getting more excited than I've ever been in my life in introducing things that people wouldn't think that they would like.
How are you cooking the ostrich? You just sear it like a steak?
Just like a steak, man. Just, you know, I do marinate it a little bit with my little dry rub, and then it goes straight on the grill. Quick, sear, a little sear, 1.5 to 2 minutes, the other side as well, and then it's on the plate. But I do make something a little different. It's called a monkey gland sauce. And people are like, what is a monkey gland sauce? Well, it doesn't have anything to do with monkeys.
It doesn't have any monkey in it. Let's just reassure people right now. But no monkeys were harmed in the making of monkey gland sauce.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if I told you this, but there were two professors in a university in London that were working with monkeys' private parts. And they were trying to clone these monkeys to, produce other monkeys with the intention of trying to clone humans. And so one day they went out after working in the test laboratories and so on. They went out and they ordered a steak that had some sauce on it. And the one professor turned around to the other guy, who happened to be a South African, said, "This looks like the monkey's glands we were working with." And so, all of a sudden, they would go back to this restaurant and order a steak and say, "We want that steak with the monkey gland sauce." And so monkey glands sauce was established long time ago in London. This guy went back to South Africa and he was asking for monkey gland steak. And that's how it started. So what is monkey gland sauce? Well, it's ketchup and Worcestershire sauce with chutney and onions and peppers. And it's just a really rich, good, kind of good old spicy, sweet marinara. And that I put on the plate with the ostrich, and people love it.
So tell me about this River Oaks location, because, you know, it was Churrasco's famously for many years, and now it's yours. What about it appealed to you? Because I won't say it's a challenging location necessarily, but it's a big commitment to move from Vintage Park and add a second location.
Yeah, that's a good question, Eric. I think, you know, for me, the one thing, there's ample parking, and that's a good thing. A lot of people are really saying, "Oh, I'm so glad you opened because there's a lot of parking here and we don't have to look for parking." So that's one big thing. The second thing that I think is, and you hit it on the head, that there is a lot of competition here, a lot of competition. And so I find that a lot of the people that live in this area, they don't gravitate too far away from here. They don't go outside of the loop. And what I thought, that, oh, I would open here and everyone would know the chef's table. No one's ever heard of me. Nobody even knows that I exist. And that's been the challenge. I mean, like, I can't believe no one's heard of the chef's table. They've heard, maybe heard of Peli Peli, maybe. But when I say, "Have you heard of Peli Peli?" they scratch their head and like, "No, I haven't." And like, wow, that's been a big challenge for me. So now I'm like having to really like reintroduce myself. And I was even thinking about going out on the street corner again and handing out samples, but I wouldn't do that here on West Ham. It's too dangerous. But so for me, the challenge is to get people in for the first time. I think if I get people in and they try the food, it's unique enough and different that they'll like it. And so that's been my biggest challenge.
And how's it been going? I mean, again, as you said, people, you know, they're coming to you maybe blind, or maybe they saw something about it online, but what is the feedback that you're getting so far from your customers in River Oaks?
Yeah. Overwhelming. We've been getting nothing but 5-star reviews, Eric. I don't know if you've seen this, but we've had several. We had a guest come in 3 weeks ago saying, "I have noticed that you have all these 5-star reviews and I don't believe it. I think you're doing something. I'm coming in to see this for myself." And they came in, they ate the food, and they gave me a 5-star review. So, you know, I mean, that was pretty cool. And that was the first time I had somebody else do that again. Same thing happened. So I know that the food is good. But, you know, the thing is, we didn't do a lot of research, Eric. I think if we did a little bit of research, we would have been better prepared. Because, number one, we don't know this area. We're finding out this area. We're learning about this area. And, I think going in, we're a little cocky, to be honest with you, thinking, "Oh, we're going to open, we're going to be packed." And I had a full complement of staff, just as big as the staff that we had up in Vintage Park, and that just didn't materialize. I mean, we opened up and it was, and we couldn't have opened up at a worse time, Eric, because people here in River Oaks, they go away, not for a week, they go away for 2 months up north, getting away from the heat. Didn't know that either. So, you know, we're now getting into a time of the year where they're coming back and the talk, there is talk. People are talking. Oh, I went to this place and it's great. You got to come try it. And now they're bringing their friends back. And I'm seeing repeat business, which is great. On Saturday night, we saw a lot of people get up and talk to each other, which is, that's a good sign. That means people are talking about it. And we're going to be this little gem in the middle of nowhere, I think, in the middle.
Right.
Of
no, I agree. When you see people talking, because it means their friends are going there, and you feel validated in the sense that, oh, if it's, you know, if my friends are going there, then I should be there. I don't want to miss out on this place. I do. I always think that's a good sign for any restaurant.
Yeah, good. Well, I hope so. And I'm trying hard. I really am. I don't know when I last tried this hard, to be honest.
Right. Not, probably not since the opening Pelly Pelly in Vintage Park
in 2009. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been a while. And I'm not getting any younger, man. I just, this year I turned 73. And
I wouldn't have said you look a day over 65.
Oh, come on. Thank you, man. Appreciate that.
You know, you've mentioned your son Kyle a couple of times. Just tell me a little bit about what it's been like working with him.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, we had an opportunity to work together when it was Pelly Pelly, and unfortunately that didn't materialize. And I know that Kyle has always wanted to be, working with his dad, although he almost went with somebody else, which I nearly scolded him for. And I think now he's really happy that we made this. And this is going to be his legacy. He's going to take this over from me when I'm not doing this anymore. And you know, Kyle is very similar to me in that I never went to school. I never had schooling. I never went to college to learn how to do any of this. He was homeschooled, his mother did an amazing job on homeschooling him, because he graduated way before he should have. But Kyle he's got street smarts, man. He's just got it. And he's intelligent. He's got an engineer background. He actually was not a very good employee. When he worked for me, when I had the pizza shops, he wasn't good, because he was always fidgeting and doing things and fixing things. So he always had that kind of like Lego building. You know, he could build a Lego car and put airplane fuel in it. That thing would zoom down the street. I mean, that's his creativity. And that was a gift that he was given. You know, and I think, you know, in life, everybody has some gift that they have. They just don't know what it is, or they don't ever get to really experience it. And then all of a sudden, one day, boom, it happens. Like, I didn't think I was going to be a chef. I never thought I'd ever be a chef. I never thought I'd be training people to cook, especially with not having gone to school. And Kyle does exactly that. He does that. The electricians, the HVAC people, just everybody in the industry go to him for advice. And he has no certifications. And he just boom, 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 rattles it off. And he makes these decisions, and they're so good and they spot on. And he even tells the architects, hey, you're off here. You didn't do this. This is not right. And, you know, I mean, I am absolutely amazed. He is incredible. I just love this boy. And not being biased, because he's my son, but he is amazing. He's done a great job. I love the way he built this restaurant and all the technology and everything that he's put together. It's really overwhelming. I couldn't be more proud as a father of a son. And so, yeah, that's my boy, Kyle.
I mean, the build-out's really impressive for anyone who hasn't been there yet. You moved the entrance. I mean, Churrasco's, it had the door kind of away from the street. You guys moved the entrance and you built yourself a really big bar area that is kind of catered to how people dine now. I don't think in the Churrasco's day, I don't think eating in the bar was as popular. I don't think restaurants saw the bar as the revenue source and the, you know, energy source that it is in contemporary restaurants. And you flip the whole layout around, and I think it makes the space more functional.
Yeah, I think it does. And, you know, we also completely redid the patio. I mean, we smashed the patio down, completely redid it. And, you know, I think sometimes you have to go in and you have to completely redo it and change it. Like when people come in, oh my God, they just are overwhelmed, especially if they were regulars of Churrasco's. But there was one thing that was a challenge, and they never had sprinklers. So when we came, we were like, oh my goodness, what are we going to do? So Kyle went down and figured out that, hey, listen, we've got a problem because there isn't enough water supply to supply sprinklers to this side of Westheimer. And so they had to tap into the north side of Westheimer, dig under the ground of Westheimer to put a riser room up in our space. Well, that took 14 months to get approved, just approved.
Wow.
And then here's the thing that really, it's amazing how the government operate, because they knew that we were going to put sprinklers and that we were coming from the north side of town. They tarred the Westheimer Road knowing this was going to happen, and then they had to dig it up, put the water pipes in, retar the road, and I mean, that took forever. I mean, I think we signed our lease about almost 18 months before we even got started. So it was an interesting challenge, you know? And even with all that, Eric, we didn't do any research. We didn't even know that we were opening at the worst time of the year. So, you know, I mean, we're still learning, Eric. You know, I don't think you ever stop learning, you know?
All right. So what are your aspirations? Where would you like to see, you know, by the end of the year, you'll be a little more than 6 months in. What are the goals that if you achieve, you'll feel like, okay, this is going well?
Yeah. Well, I'm very grateful because we're about to begin what is known as Houston Restaurant Weeks. And it starts this coming Saturday. And I remember at the very beginning with Cleverly Stone, we did quite a few events with her, and we were on Fox with her, especially myself, entering into Houston Restaurant Weeks. Back then, it wasn't quite a month. It started out as being a week, and then it became a month, and now it's 5 weeks. And Katie and I have built up a friendship because of her mom. And I've got a couple of shows coming up on Fox with her, introducing Houston Restaurant Week. So I feel like this month coming up, August, is going to help us tremendously. I feel that there is something about the, you know, when you give, expecting nothing in return, then you get more to give, and it's almost like a law of reciprocity, Eric. And I'm discovering that the older I get, the more I'm learning that. And what this time around, and I know Katie is, she actually had me speak at one of her recent little get-togethers with all the restaurants that are participating. And I told them, like, just because it's Houston Restaurant Weeks and it's a smaller menu, and we're only getting $25 for a first and a second course, doesn't mean you have to be skimpy. Because even though we're giving $3 towards the charity, people are coming there for the first time. They're coming there because they're getting a reduced price meal. They're coming there because it's a good deal. And they're coming because they're actually giving. And so as a restaurant that is doing Houston Restaurant Weeks, to me, that is my opportunity to actually gain a customer, gain a guest. And don't be skimpy with the portions. Give them good portions. Give them an opportunity to say, man, that was good value. And we're helping. We're giving to the community. And there's a restaurant that does the same. And we're here to support. So I think that's the key. And I think that's going to help us. And I think by the end of the year, hopefully, the traction will continue and that people will come back and enjoy the food that I cook.
Right. No, I think that's the right approach for any restaurant participating in HRW, especially a new restaurant. Put your best food forward. Put your best dishes on the menu. If you've got to make the portion a little smaller, or, you know, but really try to hold the line. Give people the best experience possible, and then hope that they come back. Hope that you can wow them enough to get them to come back and pay whatever the full price is on the regular menu when it's not Houston Restaurant Weeks. So I think that approach is smart, and I think it'll serve you very well.
Thanks, Eric. I think that's the key. And we also have a tournament that we did last year. We did a golf tournament for the Sunshine Kids. We raised $23,000, which was our very first time of ever doing that. And our next one's coming up on the 28th of September. And we hope to double that now that we have two locations. So here we go again. I really feel that the more that we can give, the more we can get back into the community and do those kind of things. I think we have a purpose. I think we have a plan. And I think we have an opportunity to, to be a part of our community. And this is one way of doing it.
I think that's great. I'm glad to see that you're embracing the community and that you've got a plan for growth. And, I hope it all works out.
Thanks, Eric. I really appreciate it.
All right. I have to say, that does bring me to the end of my questions. Is there anything I haven't asked you about that you would like to discuss?
I think we pretty much covered it. I do think that I'd just like to appreciate our friendship, our relationship. I'm humbled to be at this place right now. I think when I was in my Peli Peli days, I was a little bit more young and ambitious and cocky. But I've learned how to I've learned over time to be patient and to have a little bit more respect for others than just myself. So thank you very much for helping me get there.
Well, thank you for doing this. I will say before I let you go, we have to play the lightning round. Five easy questions, five short answers. Just say the first thing that comes to mind. Paul Friedman, what is your favorite ingredient?
Peri Peri.
What is the first band you ever saw in concert?
The Beatles.
Wow.
I'm not young.
I understand. What is your fast food guilty pleasure? It has to come from a restaurant with a drive-thru.
Burger King.
Who is your favorite Houston athlete, past or present?
Oh, a golfer. Freddie Couples.
Good answer. And then finally, I know you've been busy running two restaurants, but is there a new restaurant that you haven't been to yet but are dying to try?
I've been so busy, I didn't even know what restaurants are opening, to be honest with you. So I don't have an answer to that one.
That's fine. Paul, give us the website and the social media for Chef's Table.
Yeah, chefstablehouston.com.
Very good. All right, Paul, again, thank you for doing this.
Eric, thank you for having me.
Good to see you.
You too, my friend.
You can follow me on Instagram at Eric Sandler. Keep it locked on culturemap.com for all the latest Houston bar and restaurant news. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be back next week.